So, welcome to Lecture 6. It's Monday, September 19th. Lecture notes page should be 57, if I've gotten that right. And I hope that I have. So we're going to hear from Scott today, briefly about the American Marketing Association, a great opportunity for both marketing majors, business majors, and for that matter, I think others, but he'll tell you more about it. Scott? Yeah, here you go.
Check, check. Alrighty, hey, how's it going, everybody? So yeah, as Dr. Mark said, I am Scott O'Toole. I am the current president of our American Marketing Association here at Kent State, and I just want to take a couple minutes to tell you about why I think you guys should join AMA for this semester, which is obviously the question you probably have on your minds. So let's get right into it. So one of the things that we do at AMA is we have a lot of experienced guest speakers that come in. They have experience in sales, corporate experience, and of course marketing, and they've helped a lot of people with networking opportunities and just more general business opportunities as well. Something we have that's going to be fun coming up is we have a marketing tour of the Cavaliers facilities, as well as we're going to be going to the game on November 18th versus the Hornets. So if that would be something that would entice you, I would highly recommend coming to check out the group, because it's going to be a really enjoyable time. And of course, besides that, we do have more marketing knowledge and just general networking opportunities that come with being in the group. So just some information if you guys were interested. We meet currently in the business building in room 217. We meet once a week on Wednesdays from 7 to 8 p.m. Typically, our meetings usually run the full time. They never really go over for the most part, so we're going to try and keep it that way. And another thing I will mention is I know a lot of people in here are not actually marketing majors, but you might be like fashion merchandise or something like that. We allow any majors at the American Marketing Association, so if you want to check it out and you're not marketing, you're free to as well. If anything else was to entice you to come to our meeting this week, we are doing resumes. So for some of our younger students, if you need help with resumes, just general tips, or would like someone to actually go through and look at your resume, that's what we're going to be doing this week. So I encourage you guys to all come out. If you have any more questions about joining, feel free to message or email amakentstate@gmail.com. That'll go directly to me, and I'll get back to you as soon as I can. And yeah, I hope to see some of you guys this Wednesday. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Scott. Anybody have any questions for Scott about AMA?
So you got a question over there?
What if you have class at that time?
That is okay. If you have class like every week at Wednesday, unfortunately, yeah, you wouldn't really be able to do much with the group. But if you have like things that pop up, you don't have to like be required to go to a meeting or say like, oh, you're out of the group since you didn't make that meeting. So we're flexible with people's schedules. But if you unfortunately can't make it at 7 every week, then it would be kind of difficult. No problem.
But next semester, don't schedule Wednesday evening. You'll be able to join.
Exactly.
Anything else for Scott? Okay, again, thank you, Scott. All right.
Have a good rest of your day, guys.
And if you'll turn that off by person. So this is all information for you. October 12th, sign up if you're interested in meeting or seeing this interesting event. We've already seen this multiple times. So mini test 2 closed on Saturday, as it was supposed to, although I did pick a couple late people up. The average dropped to 80%. That seems lower than I would expect it to be. 96% of the students participated. And mini task 3 will open tomorrow. It'll cover Wednesday, last Wednesday's, and today's lecture and the textbook material. I'll send you email about that. So Proctorio is a bust for now. The vendor is a bust for now. Our ability to influence the vendor, bust for now. So right now, I'm going to kill off Proctorio. So we won't lock down the browser because it won't let me do the lockdown without also recording you. And, you know, that puts roughly 2,500 videos online, 500 people times 5 attempts, and I wasn't going to look at them anyhow. It's just silly. It's also silly to me that the vendor can't fix the problem. And you've got any ISIT computer people here? Maybe I can get you an internship real quick with them. So I'm not going to use it for now. We'll ramp it up for midterm and final, but that's when I did plan to have the video running. Any questions on mini test 3 as it's coming up? Okay. So the first of the optional extra credits, whether you're using PACBACK or the McGraw-Hill Connect Enhanced Learning Extra Credit, has been open since last Thursday. It's due on Wednesday by 11:59 p.m. Someone asked me Do you have to do three attempts on the enhanced reading extra credits? No, do one, two, or three. We keep your high score, but you don't have to do all three. We'll keep your high. You get 100, you're 80, or whatever you are happy with. You can stop, pack back, ask one interesting question, and answer two interesting questions for your credit. Business in the news. Have you guys heard this story, what the Patagonia owner did? Holy mackerel. We talked about Patagonia actually before. We'll probably talk about them again. The Patagonia founder gave his company away to nonprofit organizations in a fight for climate, to protect, to stop climate change. Patagonia founder Yvon Chouinard is giving away the multi-billion dollar outdoor apparel business he founded nearly 50 years ago with a goal of helping to tackle climate change. Good for him. So here's his company mission, really taken to the extreme, and a bit of corporate social responsibility. Mr. Chouinard and his family have transferred the ownership of Patagonia to a trust and to a nonprofit organization. So it's Earth is now our only shareholder. So doing good, I would say. The company made a name for itself selling fleece jackets, board shorts, and plaid shirts. The fleece vests in particular have developed a cult following from people who work in finance, while the company's environmental and social conscious practices have earned dedicated buyers in other consumer spheres. Patagonia had annual revenue of $1 billion from 2017 to 2020. So here's a bit about their target audience. And again, doing well while doing good. I don't know. Let me see if I say any more about this on the next slide. I don't. So I don't know if you know or not, but the United Nations has a series of social responsibility sustainable goals. If you come into the College of Business building off the third floor parking lot and look in the lobby area, left and right, you'll see, I forget how many, 16 of these plaques. These are all areas which the college has subscribed to, both in terms of its research, in terms of its teaching, as supporters of this UN notion of sustainability and social responsibility. So there are a bunch of these different areas, and I would say that this links up to responsible consumption and production and climate action, two of the UN goals that we subscribe to in the college. The trust, called Patagonia Purpose Trust, owns 2% of the company and all of the voting stock. It will be tasked with protecting Patagonia's existing values and independence from outside entities. So that's a bit of a unique setup. The nonprofit organization, the other side of it, is called Holdfast Collective. It owns 98% of the company and all of the non-voting stock, which doesn't give it decision-making authority. It'll be charged with taking the profits generated by Patagonia and using those funds to address climate change. Patagonia said in a statement that it expects to pay out roughly $100 million a year to Holdfast Collective, depending on the health of the business. That's putting your money and your company where your mouth is. I would say that's some pretty ethical decision making. The Holdfast Collective is a 501c4 not-for-profit organization. That designation allows it to use its money to advocate for causes and political candidates, not just to give to charities. In a 2012 interview, Chouinard said, look, I never even wanted to be in business. But he was a designer. He was an advocate. He really wanted to do his product, but not be in business per se. He's been pretty successful nonetheless. I hang on to Patagonia because it's my resource to do something good. It's a way to demonstrate that corporations can lead examined life, which I would say is business ethics. So good for Patagonia. We'll see what happens into the future. And there's always some cynics. If you would go online and read the article, there'd be a lot of cynical comments at the bottom, the way there isn't everything with social media. But I'm going to give him accolades for his attempt to do good. Chevrolet's new big EV push includes Fleetwood Mac and influencers. Chevrolet is calling on Fleetwood Mac, Conan O'Brien, and a bevy of influencers and a big media buy in NFL games to draw consumers to its growing fleet of electric vehicles. Fleetwood Mac, how many people know Fleetwood Mac? Do you guys know almost everybody? Wow. Fleetwood Mac, classic hit everywhere. Is used. It backs a new ad that debuted this last Saturday, beginning what one executive described as Chevy's largest ever campaign. So we're getting consumers' attention for their new products, and we're seeing a bit of a campaign ad spend. Let's see if we can pull up the ad that uses this background theme.
What's your name? You know that I'm falling in to Blazer, Equinox to Silverado. Chevy EVs are for everyone, everywhere.
So this is not really targeting a particular segment of the car market. It's across all their models, and it's trying to be a mass appeal to a sort of a mass audience to get them interested in the upcoming EVs. They have spotlights new electric models hitting dealerships in 2023, including the Equinox EV, Silverado EV, and Blazer EV, as well as the Bolt EV, which debuted in 2016 as Chevy's first dedicated electric vehicle. The commercial portrays singing, smiling people driving the vehicles and positions Chevy EVs as for everyone, everywhere. So sort of a brand positioning, mass marketing as an appeal. The effort continues to move by Chevy and parent company GM to be seen as a mass marketer provider of EVs for people of all ages, genders, ethnicities, and income levels. So again, appealing to a mass market in the car industry. The new campaign is notable for its size and scope. The brand declined to reveal its media investment, but this is more than Chevy has ever spent on a launch campaign. So I don't know how big the budget is, but it's a big media budget, which is what we're thinking about there. The EV segment, long dominated by Tesla, is growing as traditional automakers, including GM, Ford, Volkswagen, and others, pour billions of dollars into EVs, with their models now hitting dealerships. EVs made up 4.5% of new vehicle sales in the first 8 months of this year, up from 2.6% for all of 2021. Tesla has a 60% market share, followed by Ford at 8.4%, Honda 6%, Kia 5.1%, and Chevy at only 3.9%. So we're seeing a bit of competition in this new marketplace. Chevrolet Marketing VP Steve Majores says, "We are at a pivotal moment for the industry, and what a pivotal moment for Chevy in that we are bringing forward products that really meet what consumers are looking for from a brand they trust. My shorthand for marketing, discovering and satisfying consumer needs, wants, and desires, repeated by our good friend over here at Chevy." Finally, cats revolt against Back Market's mission to give more lives to electronic devices. I had to read that a couple times. It's not Black Market, it's Back Market. Anybody actually know in tech Back Market for any reason? Back Market seems to be a company that works with other providers where they buy back your old technology, have the providers totally refurbish it to good, better, best, and then act as an entity to help sell the product back to you. So that's Back Market as a company. Yes, sir. GameStop for bigger I think you mean as a provider to Backstock? No, because they have their own business model, right? They do that there, don't they, at GameStop? So this is going to be, you're a company that does refurbishment.
Even though they do the trading of the games, like to get new games.
Right, but they don't need Backstop. Okay. Backstop also, I don't know if GameStop's global or not. Backstop is actually headquartered in Paris, France, and does a lot of Europe stuff too. But the general concept of refurbishing stuff and selling it back, sure. So the cats are coming for us as they stage a revolution against refurbished electronics marketplace. Back Market's mission is to give second-hand devices more than one life. That's their ad theme. Back Market, launched in 2014, served customers across 16 countries across Europe and the U.S., and employs 650 people in offices in New York, Paris, Berlin, Bordeaux, and Barcelona, repairing old electrical devices and selling them on to new consumers. The company raised $510 million in January and is one of France's highest-valued unicorns at $5.7 billion. If you're not familiar with what a business unicorn is, it's a private company with a valuation of a billion or more. That's a pretty rare, extremely difficult category to get to reach. This company has done that. In its latest brand-building efforts, they've created a 360-degree campaign titled Sorry Cats. Let's see the ad, see if you like it or not, and then we'll talk about what it's getting at.
Get that. Sorry, cats. You're not the only ones. Tech now has multiple lives, too. Choose Renewed on Back Market.
So, cats aren't the only ones. Thank you. Cats aren't the only ones that have multiple lives. Back Market does, too, and cats are upset about the whole thing. This sees an uprising of our feline companions against both humanity and their devices, taking them to the company's offices where they stage their final gambit. So this idea of a 360-degree campaign, again, if we don't know the terminology, is a complete creative campaign idea across all the brand's marketing mix elements designed to implement a strategic brand identity, so at a pretty high level, usually product positioning, brand positioning. But again, discovering and satisfying consumers' needs, wants, and desires at a profit through an integrated effort of the firm. Here's an integrated effort, 360-degree marketing. Smartphones, headphones, and other devices are the cat's targets in their war to retain their own unique ownership of having more than one life. So brand positioning, humor and advertising, getting consumers' attention. This ad, at 1 minute 50 seconds, the full spot features a new brand signature, Hello Again. Shorter versions will run across Germany, then France, then Spain, followed in the UK through 2023. So we're seeing a company doing global marketing and rolling out across different countries. The signature aims to convey a message about the potential longevity of tech products while also referencing the subtly hello message that Apple users see when they switch on their products. So we're seeing brand message, brand image. Back Market is ambitious. Black Market's ambition to grow from a French challenger startup to a global leader within the circular economy. Rationally, refurbishing is amazing, says Julien Livellon at Buzzman Advertising. It's ecological, it's economical, it's the future of consumption. So again, a theme of sustainability and a bit of business ethics if you agree to that. Other activity will appear on digital cinema, outdoor display, and social media platforms. TV and digital will run three different edits at 60, 30, and 15 seconds, while YouTube will host the full minute 50-second version across Germany, Spain, the UK, and France. It also runs cinemas in France and the UK. So there's their global media strategy, how they're getting the message out. All right, so picking up. Lecture notes, page 57, page 86 in the textbook. We're still in chapter 3, and we're still talking about understanding these, if you will, crest factors. And we ended up not there. And we ended up with hearing about the economic response to economic factors, when we heard about Felber and Felber talking about his B2B business, consulting industry for businesses, and what it meant to him, if you recall from last time. So we move forward a bit to technology, CREST. Let's see if we remember any of these things. So these are the external factors outside the organization, hi Webbies, that influence our consumers, our business. So we said they're CREST. Anybody recall what C stood for? Right, competition. R, regulation, legal, and political. E, economic. S, social. And T, technology. The CREST factors, important to business, important to marketers, as we track those external factors. That's what we've been talking about. Now we're on to the T, technological factors. So obviously technology impacts consumers' choices, their view of value. In fact, I guess Back Market is playing on some of the ideas of technology. Technology means that many products continue to have reduced cost. I overuse the example of a flat screen TV. First came out at $20,000, a flat screen TV. Dropped to 15, dropped to 9, dropped to 8. My first flat screen TV for my home as a consumer, $3,000. And that was a good buy at the time. What do they sell for now? A flat screen TV? $200, right? So over time, over the product life cycle, costs go down, which means that I'm able to focus on those other things that the product has, the number of connectors, the sound type. It's not just about the money. And technology drives that change of view. Also, obviously, technology helps us to introduce new products in new ways using new technology. Important to the environment, to our competitors, to our consumers, and to us. And it can influence changes to production. For example, given the changes in social norms about the importance of recycling, technology can help us to do better sustainability, right? To do better recycling. In terms of electronic business technology, we're all well familiar with the idea of a market space, an information and communications-based electronic exchange environment, where physical boundaries no longer interfere with buy-sell decisions, also known, I would say, as the internet, the intranet, and now, upcoming, who knows what it'll mean, the metaverse. Not sure what that all will be, but it's technology at work, yeah? There are many industry-specific market spaces, which are an integration of marketplaces through sophisticated computer and telecommunications technology. And so, again, sort of market-specific sites. In a market space, information and or physical goods are exchanged. Transactions take place through computers and networks. In the consumer side, we have electronic commerce. Also in the B2B side, intranet, the using technology within the scope of our business, within the scope of our relationships to our vendors, to our wholesalers and retailers, to share information, critically important to getting stuff done efficiently and effectively. Extranets, an extension of the organization's intranet that's extended to users outside. I guess I pushed intranet too soon. Intranet inside our organization, extranet outside our organization, to our partners, vendors, and suppliers. But isolation from everybody else. Nobody else is supposed to be able to see all this importantly shared information. What's happened during the COVID-19 in this domain? Well, arguably for retail, e-commerce is the most significant retail digital transformation ever. COVID has forced retailers to invest more money into new technologies and implement those technologies much more quickly than they otherwise planned to do. Retailers that had not yet started to sell online either went out of business during the pandemic or transformed their businesses to include e-commerce. The coronavirus accelerated e-commerce growth trends significantly. The U.S. commerce penetration jumped to more than 25% in April 2020 from 15% at year-end 2019, pulling forward several years of adoption of e-commerce within the U.S. So, interesting impact of an external factor on us. Due to COVID-19, a variety of digital channels have become used for the first time. So 35% of people surveyed said for the first time ever they used live chat, 33% internet voice video, 29% regular video, et cetera, et cetera. So it pulled that entire use of technology forward a considerable amount as people coped with the pandemic. And of course, many people are staying up with this change in technology, right? You've heard, of course, that many people are fighting going back to the office. They're happy working from home. They don't feel like they want to go back to the office 5 days a week. So now we hear, and when it works, it's funny, and I think you'll still know who this business expert is. We'll see in a minute. An expert manager's reaction to the impact of technological changes on a traditional business that this expert operates in. Let's see if it works for me.
Okay, well, we can do questions. Okay, very good. First hand up.
Sir, as a company that primarily distributes paper, how have you adapted your business model to function in an increasingly paperless world?
We can't overestimate the value of computers. Yes, they are great for playing games and forwarding funny emails, but real business is done on paper, okay? Write that down.
So first of all, what's the humor here? Who's this guy? Who's this expert? We don't know him. That makes it less funny. Nobody knows Michael Scott from the TV show The Office. Oh, that's who that is. All right. So Michael Scott is a comedy show about a business, a paper company. He's the not very bright manager of the company. He's been invited by his intern to talk to the MBA class about a variety of things, but they ask, how is your company, a traditional old paper company, adapted? And what does he say? Well, he recognizes the factor. Yeah. Computers are out there, sure, for silly stuff. But business is done on paper. Write that down. Of course, it swings the classroom, and everybody's typing their answers. What's the point I'm trying to get here? You will run into this equivalent in your real world of business. You're going to run into a manager who sees this external factor, technology in this case, looks at it in the face, and poo-poos it. It's not important for us. And that's not a good way to go. So you don't want to ignore these factors. You want to figure out what it means for your company, whatever business you're in. All right, which is what we've been talking about. Now, paper, of course, is a old traditional business, but it's still out there doing stuff. This is an actual ad for a paper company, Astro Brights, and they're trying to get your attention. Imagination comes boldly to life with Astro Brights papers, ideal for use at work, home, and school. Choose among 23 vibrant colors in a variety of sizes, weights, and assortments. Let your ideas soar with the possibility of Astro Brights. Not making use of technology especially, but still, hey, what can we do to keep consumer interest in our old company? A little excitement. All right, see, competitive forces. So, what is competition? Well, it's the other firms or organizations or people that would just love to take your customers or your clients from you. How? By providing better satisfaction than you do, can do, or want to do. And if they can provide better value and satisfy your customers better than you do, why would anybody stay with you? So it's good to keep your eyes on competition. Your success will come from finding a better way to satisfy customers, not by focusing on your need to beat competition. Because the way to beat competition is by providing better satisfaction to your customers, paying attention to them. So just trying to, quote, beat competition is not a good way to go, not a good look. So what are some forms of competition that are out there? Well, the first would be pure competition. In pure competition, you have a very large number of sellers of this product, whatever it is. The products themselves are fairly similar to one another. So there's not a lot of ways to differentiate your product from another seller's. And so distribution becomes very important. Product, place, price, promotion, place is very important. So agricultural products like corn, wheat, soybeans. Have you heard of soybeans? You've heard of it? What's your favorite brand of soybean? What? It's a commodity. I don't have a favorite brand. Okay? So that's pure competition. Large number of sellers, similar products that can't be differentiated. You just have to make sure your product's available in the marketplace. You're not going to get a deal by offering a higher or lower price. The market sets the price. Monopolistic competition. In this case, there are many competitors in the marketplace. No one firm has significant control over the market price. Each company produces a similar product line, but as you'll see in a minute, some differentiation is possible. So a large number of sellers, products are unique, but some substitution can occur. Pricing is important. Examples include restaurants, large number of sellers, products are unique, but you can't substitute one restaurant for another. Price can be important. Cereals, shoes, shampoos, toilet paper, large number of sellers, there's some differentiation. Pricing can be important in the mix, but the brand name can help as well. All right? Oligopoly. Here, the market is dominated by a small number of sellers, so a few very large competitors have the majority of the market share. The products themselves often are very similar to one another, so promotion is key to demonstrate the differences in those products among those few market competitors. I don't know if you know this or not, but if you're talking about the beer industry, major players, not the local, what do we call it, craft beer, there are only two major producers of beer, Anheuser-Busch and Miller Coors. The health insurance market is dominated by Anthem and Kaiser Permanente. Video game consoles, we got Microsoft, we got Nintendo, we got Sony, and what else is there? What is it?
Sega.
Sega.
Not anymore.
Yeah. Are they still around? So anyhow, even if we included them, there's still only a few of them. Well, let's not over-debate the point. The point is generally there are only a few big competitors. Products are relatively similar. Promotion is the key to demonstrate product differences for an oligopoly. And finally, we have a pure monopoly, a single producer. It's a unique product, unsubstitutable. The marketing mix really is not an important factor for a monopoly. What's an example of monopoly from microecon or whatever? Monopoly?
Standard Oil.
Standard Oil in its day, maybe, but now there are a lot of...
This is pre-Sherman.
Yeah. In the old days, what about today? What's still a monopoly? I'm going to go with utilities. What are you going to substitute for water? And how many water companies do you get to shop from that in your neighborhood, right? So water, natural gas, electric companies are the typical examples of pure monopolies. And marketing mix is really not very important to them. So this is just another way of looking at this as a continuum of competition. For pure competition number of sellers, you have large, monopolistic, also large, oligopoly, few, monopoly one. Product differentiation for pure competition, they're very similar. Soybean is soybean. Monopolistic competition, unique but substitutable. Oligopoly, similar products. And monopoly, unique and not substitutable. What are you substituting for water? Marketing mix, pure competition. You got to have your product out there. That's the way it's going to get sold. Distribution is important. Monopolistic competition, pricing is important. They consider your brand, but also how do you your toilet paper's price compared to the other guys. Oligopoly, promotion is key to achieve these perceived product differences. Monopoly, just not that important to monopoly.
So where would like Microsoft fall with regards to like Windows and Office? Would that fall under the oligopoly?
Well, who else can, is there somebody else that sells a desktop solution other than Microsoft?
There are some.
There are some.
Their market share is so
teeny. They're small.
I wasn't sure if it fell under oligopoly or if that fell under oligopoly or monopoly.
Well, usually we wouldn't consider, as to my knowledge, we wouldn't consider Microsoft as a monopoly because there is water you can't substitute for.
Okay.
A Windows desktop, you could substitute it
Apple.
With, well, you could substitute with Apple. You could do Linux.
Yeah.
There are other choices out there. So what's the importance for you as a business in thinking about competition, what kind of competition you exist in? Well, we have to recognize that consumers have limited buying power. If consumers had all the money in the world, it wouldn't matter. They could buy everything out there. It would not matter who your competitor was. They don't care. It's only money. For most people, they care. Money counts. And the companies that are out there have to compete for those dollars in order to stay in business. And they have to compete at the brand level, which is the most obvious place. So here we have competition among brands selling the same type of product. So Colgate toothpaste, who might they compete with? For example, they might compete with Crest, and they might compete with Arm & Hammer, right? So those are all toothpaste from different companies competing against one another for your product dollar. Anybody use Colgate? Anybody use Crest? Anybody use Arm & Hammer? Teeny market share. All right, so there. Hold on. I can't hear you if you're that far away.
Well, I was also thinking that they compete with, like, Sensodyne toothpaste.
Oh, yeah. I'm just giving you. Oh, absolutely. There's a whole slew of them that are out there that are going to compete at the brand level. I was just popping up three. Yes, I will use Sensodyne actually later on in our examples of toothpaste when we come to that. So yeah, these are all brand area competition. But you also have to think about how consumers spend their dollars at the product level. So for example, here we're thinking about products that don't compete directly with each other, but you might be competing with. Sure. People could spend their entertainment dollars on the Cleveland Guardians, yeah? What other major baseball team in Cleveland can they spend their money on? There is no other team. But what could they spend their entertainment dollars on other than the Cleveland Guardians?
New York Yankees.
I'm talking about in Cleveland, locally. So, well, the Cleveland Browns, the Cleveland Orchestra, and more generally, you can spend them on streaming, Netflix, Sling, PlayStation. So it may not be obvious immediately to think that these guys compete with each other, but at the entertainment level, they do. So what's that mean to you as a business? Who else are you competing with?
Well,
And finally, we can talk about at the company level. So in some sense, consumers have to choose where they're going to spend their money at all. Wilson Sporting Goods, Levi's Clothing, transportation, charities. Do you imagine people shift their attention when inflation is really high and recessions come in among these various types of companies? Obviously they do. What's that mean to you and your business? I don't know, you have to. So how does your firm successfully compete? Well, you've got to find your differential advantage, what we often call your unique selling proposition. If you went out of business, would anybody miss you? Would anybody care? Or would they just fill in the gap? Who even knew you were there? If the second's the answer, then you're probably going out of business. Having gained this unique selling proposition, this differential advantage, you have to find ways to keep it. Keep it against competition. Keep it against changing environmental forces, changing consumer tastes, changing technology, changing social norms. Or else competition will be happy to take your customers away. So what is your unique selling proposition? How are you going to keep it in the future? Owen, what is your company's unique selling proposition?
Quality service.
Quality service. Owen does landscaping, right? Around the Pittsburgh area, right? Quality service, local service. Okay, and so he's got to keep that in mind for his customers.
From food?
So this is, for me, a fun description of a whole industry that was going to pretty much ignore competition and ignore changes. Pretty soon realized that wasn't really a good way to success in the future and eventually changed out. Let's see if this works for us.
From food to wine, Italy has finally signed on to the global trend toward wine in a box. That's right, the Department of Agriculture, Food and Forestry has authorized producers to package some wines in non-glass containers. Ray Isle is deputy wine editor for Food and Wine magazine. He joins us from New York. Thanks for being with us.
No, thanks for having me.
It sounds like this was a long debate in Italy. What finally changed their minds?
Well, many things are a long debate in Italy.
Yes.
What finally changed their minds, I think, was a realization that they weren't going to be able to compete in a global market, which is what wine has become, without changing some of these traditional restrictions they have on regional wines. Because box wine is without any question a wave of the future. I mean, its percentage of the wine market keeps increasing with every passing year. What's interesting is that the real shift has been towards higher end box wine, and this is exactly what this Italian decision represents. What you won't see are wines like Brunello di Montalcino, Barolo, Chianti Classico, which are truly the most famous Italian wines. You will see wines like Rosso Canero, Dolcetto d'Alba, Rosso di Montalcino, wonderful wines, just not the absolute premier top of the heap.
What are the numbers here? How much of a demand is there now?
Well, there's a tremendous demand for boxed wine. You know, in some markets, like in Northern Europe, let's say, where Italy does sell a lot of wine, you know, it may be 50% of the market.
Okay.
In the U.S., I forget where it is exactly, but I think it's in the sort of 9 to 12% at this point and growing rapidly. And one thing, you know, one reason that boxes are immensely popular with wine producers is that they're much cheaper than bottles. It's about, a factor of 10 to 1 in terms of packaging cost.
Is there no downside, no weird aftertaste from that bag?
Well, you wouldn't want to do it for a wine that you're going to age over time. You would eventually, I can only assume, get some kind of chemical interaction between the polyethylene bag that's in the inside the box and the wine itself. So definitely wouldn't want to put your first growth Bordeaux in a bag inside a box. But for, you know, a kind of wonderful, you know, juicy, friendly Dolcetto Alba, why not? And what you're also going to start seeing are Tetra Paks, which are like juice boxes.
Don't tell the Italians.
Yeah, it's a slippery slope once you start on this box thing. You'll find your wine in all sorts of containers. I got an aluminum tube full of wine the other day at work. Sort of an interesting twist.
What are these Tetra Paks like?
Tetra Paks, if you think of a juice box and then expand it to a 1 liter size, it's similar to a box of wine, except that it doesn't have the plastic bag inside. So it's really like it's almost like a milk carton of wine. They're very, eco-friendly. They're recyclable. They have, much less of a carbon footprint. You can flatten them out once you're done with them. And the virtue that a box has over a Tetra Pak is that inside that plastic bag, there's no air. And when you open the spigot and pour yourself a glass of wine, the bag shrinks down as the wine goes out, and there's never any air in it. So the wine actually lasts quite a bit longer than something like a bottle or a Tetra Pak. You can have, open your box of Rosso di Montalcino, and 3 weeks later, it'll still be good.
No straw on that Tetra Pak?
Believe it or not, I think I did see an Australian Tetra Pak wine that did have a straw come with it.
Those which, Australians.
You know, the Australians, whatever the trend is, they're going to be out way in front of it.
Well, Ray Isle, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me. Thanks very much.
Ray Isle is Deputy Wine Editor for Food & Wine magazine.
And so here we have exactly what I talked about with technology. An industry, of course, is made up of a group of managers. In Italy, they say, stupid boxes, we're not going to do that. We're Italian. We have our wine in bottles. Oh, wait a minute, 50% of the market has gone away? Maybe we should reconsider that trend and allow our wines to be sold in boxes too. So it is a real trend. It impacted the industry. They had to wake up, perhaps later than they should have, to that fact. 2018 in the U.S. wine industry, new packaging, innovation in packaging seems to be well accepted by Americans. 49% growth rate of wine in cans, 37% wine on tap, 18.5. So my wife, I think, if I mentioned she's a Francophile, she loves France, have I said that? So she goes over for extended time periods. I get a chance to visit her periodically if I'm lucky. So I go over there one time. She's in a local grocery store. And they have, in the grocery store, a series of wine taps. You bring in your bottle, recyclable, reusable. You fill the bottle from the wine tap, cork it up, and take it up front and pay for that. I haven't seen that yet here that I know of, filling up your wine bottle from the grocery store, maybe at your grocery store. 18.5% Tetra Pak, 15.2% box, 7.5% plastic. Considering that most of these containers, with the exception of boxed wines, are relatively new to the U.S. market in the past few years, they've been available in other countries for decades, this is pretty amazing growth of this new product way of delivering product in the U.S. What's your competition doing? Pay attention. 2020, cans and convenience were very important. Outdoor activities on the rise, desire for more convenience. Wine in cans, Tetra Paks, and plastic containers will continue to grow in the U.S. market. In 2020, canned wine actually grew 61% in dollar growth. People were drinking a lot in 2020 during the pandemic, causing a can shortage in the supply chain. Small bottles and large box formats also grew in popularity, with 375 milliliters growing at 53% in value, 3-liter boxes, 31% value. This is an era ripe for innovation as packaging designers try to figure out new and attractive ways to sell wine in boxes, cans, Tetra Paks, and plastic containers. And if that's what your competition is doing, I suspect you better be paying attention. Then we have political, legal, and regulatory forces. This is a whole field itself, and eventually many of us will take a course in business law, so I don't go into it very much. You should read about it in the book in case it's testable. But you have money in fiscal policy, social legislation and regulation, regulation on competition, and regulation to protect consumers, including a variety of these acts that you can read about. The interesting thing about this element is it really does depend on the particular political party in power and their particular view of these various rules. So the laws exist. Whether or not we bother to enforce them or not varies quite a bit depending on the particular political party and their particular view of these different areas. So you have to have your antenna up to see what's going on with these as well. Trends in economics and politics of July 2022. The U.S. economy is expected to slow. COVID economic relief programs are coming to an end, a political factor. The Federal Reserve continues to tighten monetary policy, and if inflation is more persistent than expected, the Fed will need to tighten more, which will further slow the recovery. What's the latest Fed? What do we think the Fed's going to raise up this week? Anybody following the Fed? How much?
I heard
0.75, yeah, is what I heard as well. There's some concern it might be as much as one, but either way, it's true in July. It's still true here in September, impacting consumers and business. Most workers' wages have failed to keep up with inflation, eroding the purchasing power of households. As of July, the odds of the U.S. economy falling into recession next year are greater than 50%. So what does all of this mean for marketers? I just saw a scroll that Goldman Sachs, a pretty major financial entity in the U.S., is planning to lay off hundreds of workers. They do economic forecasting. I'm suspicious, although I don't have an insight on this. They're expecting an upcoming recession and getting ahead of it. We'll see what happens. All right, so scanning the marketing environment, figuring out what it means to consumers, figuring out what it means for our business and how we should react. Chapter 3. We've alluded to, as of today's Business and Marketing in the News, a bit about marketing and business ethics. I wish I didn't have to talk about it because I wish it was just a thing that people did. It is not. So we're in Chapter 4, Lectures and Notes, pages 63. Here you see my little diagram, corporate social responsibility with a variety of things. And it's one of our learning objectives, understanding the ethical aspects of marketing. Who's had a course in philosophy and, you know, ethics? A couple, bunch of people. So some of you have some idea, at least generally in society, philosophically, what we mean when we talk about ethics and morals and different sorts of perspectives, teleological, deontological, etc. But in general, ethics is the moral principles and values that guide the actions and the decisions of an individual or a group. So in philosophy, you're often talking about a society. Business ethics involves sort of what's right and wrong in the workplace, and then doing right. And unethical business behavior can get you investigated, fired, fined, and jailed. So this is where I sometimes repeat, don't lie, don't cheat, don't steal. In the classroom, in your personal life, in business. Because you can get investigated, fired, fined, jailed. So we do get pushback from managers in general, no one in specific. Why do we need this? It's really religion, ethics, morals, it's not business. Or our people are ethical, till they're not. Or it's just for philosophers, it's not for managers, it's not for business people. Or it's obvious do good, or it's just being preachy, or it's just a recent fad, or ethics can't be managed, or it's the same as social responsibility, or if your firm isn't in legal trouble, it's being ethical. Or managing ethics has little practical relevance. I would disagree with that, and a whole series of examples would tend to support my notion that it's important. The example is getting old, but you understand how easy it is to get into ethical issues when I bring up Nestle's infant formula misadventure in Africa. Anybody happen to know what this example was? You do? Or you, no, you're nodding at the cats. All right. So we know Nestle's, right, as a company. We don't have bad feelings about Nestle's in general. They're a pretty good company to the extent we know anything about them. Nestle has a very large product line. One of the things that they manufacture throughout the world is infant formula. So they have an idea to get penetration in Africa. And you know, in the US, maybe you don't know, but when you go to a hospital, you have a baby, they give you like a little goodie bag. It's got some diapers in it, it's got some infant formula in it, it's got some other sorts of things in it to take home. They say, let's do that in Africa, who so far sees that this is a terrible ethical issue and they're making a horrible mistake. Oh, you do? Do you know? Do you already know where I'm headed? Okay, you're actually on a very good track. So I'm gonna follow up with your guess with exactly what it turns out to be, but you should have been a manager for them. So they go there, and we have women in African villages come to the big city, to the hospital, have their kid, and they get a little goodie bag. And now they go back to the village. And in the goodie bag is this infant formula. And so their mental attitude is sort of a cultural thing. Hey, this is what Western culture is doing. We should do it too, which is sort of your point. In order to make infant formula work, what do you need to add to it? Water, okay? Do you imagine there's a lot of good, clean, pure water in a lot of poor African villages? There is not. Plus, is that product free? It costs money. So if you are trying to make it last, what are you going to do? You're going to use less than you should. So now we have a bunch of people in Africa, yep, using dirty water with less formula than they should, trying to, you know, be Western. And what's it replacing? Free, healthy, sanitary mother's milk, the cultural thing. So Nestle's did that. I'm pretty sure they did not on purpose try to harm villagers' babies, but that's the way it turned out. Somebody needed to think a little more like you did. Manville got knew for years that its asbestos was harming employees. People were getting sick and dying from it. They kept it up. They were sued out of existence. E.F. Hutton got busted for a financial cutting scheme. Union Carbide, not so much marketing, but in terms of manufacturing, had no quality control in its plant in Bhopal, and when it blew out, it killed thousands of Indians. Enron got busted for conflicts of interest. Kenneth Lay, who presided over the Enron accounting scandal, died before serving his prison sentence, but he was prosecuted and sentenced to prison. WorldCom MCI got it busted for inflated accounting reports. Bernard Edwards of WorldCom served half his prison time for fraud, dying shortly after his release. Martha Stewart, there's an interesting case. How many of you guys heard that she got busted for insider trading? Usually you would think that that would ruin your brand image. Her brand image is so strong, she was able to come back from that and still be successful. Not my perfect example of bad behavior being punished, but nonetheless. You guys know about Bernie Madoff? Yeah, he did a cutting pyramid scheme. First he went into jail, he went into bankruptcy, his kid committed suicide. Madoff died in 2021, he was serving a 150-year prison term. Don't lie, don't cheat, don't steal. Volkswagen cheated on the emissions test. They got a $14.7 million settlement against them. Who heard of the Fry Festival? Anybody know the Fry Festival? No? This thing had nothing behind it but the best promotional ads for a non-existent product you've ever seen. This guy defrauded hundreds of people out of big bucks with a great set of ads that were entirely defrauding.
Hyundai Tucson versus Honda CRV. Hyundai Tucson wins.
The actual experience exceeds all expectations and is something that's hard to put in words. All these things that may seem big and impossible are not. It gives people that type of energy, that type of
just goes on and on and on like that. Who would want to sign up for a weekend, like for 2 weekends like that? Music festival, food, fun, adventure. He billed you big bucks up front and then started spinning stuff. You'd have to buy a bracelet for each day, and each bracelet was hundreds of dollars more, etc. There was nothing behind this. People got to the island. There were no facilities. There weren't bathroom facilities. There was no band. It was a total ripoff. Billy McFarland was sentenced to 6 years in federal prison in October 2018, and in 2022 was released from federal prison custody and moved into a halfway house. Don't lie, don't cheat, don't steal. Wells Fargo opened fraudulent customer accounts, which maybe you heard about. They had a $185 million fine, $5 million refunded to customers, thousands of layoffs, and they had to come back. You're gone? And they had to come back. Somewhere here I have a set of ads that show them repairing their image, but maybe not, because they screwed up. Let's see if this comes up for me.
We know the value of trust. We were built on it. Back when the country went west for gold, we were the ones who carried it back east. By steam, by horse, by iron horse. Over the years, we built on that trust. We always found the way.
Then you lost it.
Until we lost it. But that isn't where the story ends.
Right.
It's where it starts again. With a complete recommitment to you.
Yeah.
Fixing what went wrong, making things right, and ending product sales goals for branch bankers. So we can focus on your satisfaction. We're holding ourselves accountable to find and fix issues proactively. Because earning back your trust is our greatest priority. It's a new day at Wells Fargo, but it's a lot like our first day. Wells Fargo, established 1852, reestablished 2018.
Because you screwed up. So what they did was had unreasonable goals for bank managers to have sales of products, and because of that, people were doing signing up customers without them knowing they were signing them up for accounts and whatever. It just became a practice. It was wrong, and they had to recover it. And Cy, founder CEO John Kapoor, and four execs of the pharmaceutical company Insys were found guilty in a scheme involving bribes and kickbacks to physicians who prescribed large amounts of a fentanyl spray to patients who didn't need the painkiller. He's serving 5.5-year prison system. It goes on and on. People don't use good sense. Don't lie, don't cheat, don't steal. In the classroom, in your personal life, in your business, please. And then I won't have to do this lecture again. All right, Nike, a pretty good company, has been dunned for having questionable practices in a variety of areas. They've been criticized heavily for not being socially responsible in general. They've been accused of using sweatshops and child labor overseas in horrible working conditions. They've been accused of targeting low-income families by making their shoes an expensive status symbol that are highly desired by poor urban street kids who cannot afford them. They, of course, have reacted to this. So, for example, they have a code of conduct and a 6-point plan that is intended to ensure more socially responsible labor practices. They commissioned an independent study of Nike factories overseas to try to assure that they're going to stop having these issues. Here from their website is a bit of their sustainability policies in manufacturing, their code of conduct, their standards, etc. So they've tried to correct those things. They created a huge social responsibility department. They publish a corporate responsibility report to tell people how they're doing. And the Nike Foundation works to create positive social change around the world by getting kids active and instead of trying to make their product something that is a status symbol for people that can't afford it. So things happen, we try to correct them. If you study philosophy, you may indeed have talked about the issues of what's ethical versus what's legal. So you have this interesting little question. Can you think of anything, it doesn't have to be in business or marketing, that might be ethical even though it's illegal? Something that might be ethical even though it's illegal. No example. We do have an example. I'm going to run up here, watch your connections. So can you yell it out? Taking from the rich, Robin Hood, taking from the rich and giving to the poor. I'd have to think about how you're doing that. Let's hold that in abeyance for the moment and see if we can get any better examples of something that might be ethical but illegal, but maybe I like what you're thinking. I don't know. Yeah?
Collecting rainwater in California.
Doing what to rainwater?
Collecting rainwater.
Is it illegal?
I
didn't know that. All right, so if it's illegal to collect rainwater in California and you collecting it, it might be the ethical thing to do. But perhaps it's against a policy. It's illegal. If you find somebody injured by the roadside and you're going to get them to a hospital quicker than an ambulance and you run some stop signs and stoplights and get them there safely, is that legal? Probably not. Is it ethical? Probably. All right? So you can think of things where there are situations where something might be illegal but ethical. Can you think of situations where something might be unethical but legal? Hello. Hi, Mom. Yo.
I was thinking like people who smoke cigarettes, that's unethical, but it's like kind of sort of legal when you turn 18.
Okay, to the extent that society does not benefit from your individuals who smoke cigarettes, become ill, get cancer, clog up the system, it's certainly legal to do that, but you could argue. Drinking and driving would be illegal. Might not be ethical. It's a hand here.
A lawyer didn't like someone of a killing charge. Or?
a lawyer getting off someone who probably is guilty. It's legal to do that, but it's probably not ethical, although everyone deserves a good defense. All right, so there are lots of examples out there, right? I go in as a company and I buy up a small town's entity, I acquire their biggest employer, and I say, what the heck, I'm just gonna shut it down. Is that legal to shut down the plant that I just bought? Is it ethical? Maybe you could find another way to do things, all right? So what's this mean? If something's unethical and illegal, I hope I don't have to talk with you about it, dear manager. It's unethical and illegal. Don't do that. And if it's ethical and legal, it's not a problem in our domain, so it's fine. You can consider it. But what do you do in these other areas where something might be ethical but illegal or unethical but legal? You got to have some way of surfacing the problem as a manager and then finding a way to deal with it. How are you going to deal with these things that are, quote, questionable? Marketers do have their share of critics. Anybody have the old crusty grandpa or uncle at Thanksgiving who thinks business is terrible and all marketing is terrible and they're always talking bad about the system? One person, nobody, a couple people. So you get the idea that there are people out there that are just against everything that those dang marketers do, driving up prices, etc., and everything that business does. Some criticisms are legitimate. Let's take a look at what some of these criticisms are. Marketers get criticized for driving up the price of products, creating high prices. Can you buy generic aspirin at this local store, just, you know, store brand? Is it more or less expensive than the national brand? Well, then clearly the national brand is just driving up prices. Deceptive practices. I'm going to make an argument about high prices. I'm not going to argue about deceptive practice. If you're cheating the consumer, you're wrong. That's a legitimate criticism. High pressure selling, usually a bad thing. Shoddy, harmful, unsafe products, bad, legitimate criticism. Planned obsolescence, we can talk a little bit about. Poor service to disadvantaged consumers, certainly unethical, if not illegal. And all of these things for which marketers are criticized do have impacts on consumers, do impact society as a whole, and if you're lying, cheating, and stealing in your business dealings, it affects other businesses too. So we have to be aware of these sorts of things. Let's take a look at some of these criticisms and see where we stand on them. Let's start with the idea of high prices. Undoubtedly, business and marketing does increase the cost of products compared to what they would be if you just drove out to the manufacturer's plant and picked them up, let's say. Or, you know, if you drove to a coffee plantation in Brazil and picked up your coffee, it's more expensive to get it at the local store. But these costs are caused by the distribution effort, getting the thing from the manufacturing plant to the store to you, getting it from Brazil to the plant to the store to you. And these people need to make money. There's markups involved there. So consumers want things like convenience. I don't want to drive to the manufacturing plant to pick up my next mechanical pencil. They want lots of assortment. I don't want to go out to a manufacturing plant and buy a barrel of nails for my little home project. I want the little kit that has a bunch of nails, maybe some screws, some wire in it. They want easy return privileges, etc. Somebody has to provide that value, but it costs money to do that. Drives the price up. And most of us, how many of us like buying brand name products in general? I like brand names. Brand names? One person. Most of us like generic. We don't want to know the brand. We don't care what it is. It's a store brand. Many of us like brand names, and getting those names out there costs money, advertising and promotion. So how many people like Levi's? Three people. I'm going to find out what you people do in your life. Or Coca-Cola, or Heineken, or Harrods, or Nike. Those brands that many of us, apparently not all, Webby's, do you buy brands? Those brands cost money to promote, to build the image in our mind. Jacks up the price, but we want it. Here's my example of aspirin. So you go into the store, whatever day this was, Rite Aid aspirin, $2.49, Bayer aspirin, $6.49. Why is there such a difference between this generic and branded product prices? Well, in part, it's due to the cost of advertising. Why would anybody pay $6.49 for Bayer instead of $2.49 for Rite Aid? Isn't aspirin aspirin? How many of you guys would buy the branded one, whatever the brand is? You would buy the branded one. How many of you guys would buy the Rite Aid one, the cheap one? College students. Why would you pay extra money, sir? Are you a rational consumer? Why would you pay extra money for the...
I just wouldn't take the risk of the cheaper medicine.
Wouldn't take the risk of the cheaper medicine. But I promise you they're the same. I'm not going to take the risk. It's my health. I can afford it. I'm worth it. I'm going to spend the extra dollars. Should we criticize him for that? Or is it okay? This is probably getting outdated as we discover more and more about cancer, but let's go with it for the moment. This is research from a while ago. Research shows that there are 200 genes involved with colon and breast cancers, okay? So with 200 different genes interacting to create the cancer, it explains why tumors from the same organ look different across patients and why some medicines help some consumers, some patients, and not others. So this is tricky to do and expensive as anything to research. Why would a firm spend the money trying to figure this problem out if you say to it, no, you're going to have to keep prices low. You can't charge big prices. I say, that's fine. I'm not doing the research. I'm done. There was just an NPR news story, I digress, it's not teachable, that was on the topic of schizophrenia. And they were talking, depression. And they were talking about understanding depression. And the traditional understanding of depression from the 80s was it's just an imbalance in the brain. You give people serotonin, it should fix everything. So manufacturers created serotonin. They were done. That was fixing depression. Of course, it doesn't work that easy, as we find out more recently. And the conversation, which is much more complicated than I'm laying out here, ended with the idea that these days, no one's researching anything about pills, medicine for depression. We're done. And the researcher, or the guy doing the interview said, and I wish they were spending more money to research it more. But for right now, it's not of interest. So people aren't going to do research and invest a lot of money for these important things unless they know they're going to get money back. Now, does that mean that this can't be an area for misbehavior too? No, of course. You can always find bad people doing bad things in any area. May 2019, Attorney General from more than 40 states are alleging the nation's largest generic drug manufacturers conspired to artificially inflate and manipulate prices for more than 100 different generic drugs, including treatments for diabetes, cancer, arthritis, and other medical conditions. The lawsuit, filed in federal court in Connecticut Friday, whatever day that was, also names 15 individual senior executives responsible for sales, marketing, and pricing. In 2022, Teva, one of the companies involved, paid out $430 million to settle this particular charge. You can always find bad people doing bad things. Fortunately, that doesn't mean that all marketers are bad people doing bad things, but there are bad people out there doing bad things. Illegal price fixing. In June 2020, former Bumblebee Foods CEO Chris Leshewski was sentenced to more than 3 years in prison for conspiring to fix prices for canned tuna. What are you doing, dude? What are you doing? And four poultry industry executives from JBS-owned Pilgrim's Pride and Claxton Poultry were indicted by Department of Justice on price fixing and bid rigging. Each executive faces a maximum penalty of 4 years in prison and $1 million fine. In 2022, they were acquitted, but in 2020, Pilgrim's Pride Corporation agreed to pay $110.5 million fine. That might go to my man's example over here of a lawyer getting you off when you're pretty much guilty, but we get you off. So that might be that at play. High prices. So markups that result in high prices often, not always, reflect services that customers want and willing to pay for, the convenience of getting it 24/7 at your local market, the image bear over the generic product. Safety, I feel safer with this product. Service, return privileges, warranties. Okay? Those all drive high prices. Illegal price fixing, though, don't do that, does have consequences. Hopefully, you go to jail, you get fined, and you're out of business. Deceptive practices, I have no support for or sympathy for. There's not an argument on the plus side. Falsely advertising factory prices or wholesale prices or large reductions from phony high retail list prices, not true, not accurate, deceptive, bad. The mortgage rates that were false and created the mortgage rate bust several years ago, led to the recession, not good. Now, some companies will say 50% off of manufacturer's suggested retail price, and in the fine print at the bottom, it might say this product may never have been offered at the manufacturer's suggested retail price in our store. Okay, at least you're being honest with the teeny headline under the big headline. But just outright lying about it with no qualifier, that's not good. Proposed 2020 class action lawsuit claims that Old Navy lists false or misleading original prices to create the illusion that items are being sold at a discount. Old Navy, really? Come on. All right, deceptive promotion, overstating a product's features or performances, running rig contest. The medical field seems fraught with difficulty. Pfizer was fined $2.3 billion with a B for promoting the sale of Bextra for several uses and dosages that the FDA specifically declined to approve due to safety concerns, and they promoted it for that. That would be deceptive. You should pay $2.3 billion. Not good behavior. This is the Willow Curve, a product that was promising pain relief. FTC entered into a $22 million settlement with the manufacturer of Willow Curve regarding unsubstantiated pain relief claims and deceptive native advertising. You're lying to the public. You're making false claims. You're deceptively promoting your product. Deceptive endorsement practices that may be met by FTC enforcement include but not limited to falsely claiming an endorsement by a third party on your website, misrepresenting whether an endorser is an actual customer or a current customer or a recent customer or never used the product, using an endorsement to make deceptive performance claims. These people said it's true even though it isn't, but it's them. No. Failing to disclose an unexpected material connection with an endorser. I'm paying these people to endorse my product. And misrepresenting that experience of the endorsers that represents a typical ordinary experience when it isn't, all of these things can get you in trouble. I'm out of time with deceptive promotion. We'll pick up with more bad behavior next time. End of material right here for Mini Test 3. I'll send you more details.